How many of you have gotten started on the homework assignment that's due Thursday? Okay, any problems that you've run into?
Drawing the scale stuff.
Drawing?
Do you ever recommend like Word or PowerPoint or Excel?
A lot of people do them in PowerPoint, because PowerPoint you can have a ruler, and you can just make a little box, and you know, depending on what your scale is, then you say, all right, the horizon is 25 centimeters deep, so that's maybe 1 millimeter per centimeter, however you want to do it, but that's one way. Certainly not the only way. One thing I wanted to mention on last Thursday, as you're doing this, this may be something that is not an issue for most of you, but if you've gotten to the point where you go to the NRCS official series descriptions, one thing you have to be careful about, when you click on this view OSD, that's official series description by series name, what's going to happen is you'll wait and wait and wait. One thing about this website, it is down occasionally for maintenance and you might have trouble with it. But so when you get ready to put in the series name, one of the examples we've used around here is the Palouse silt loam, right? Well, look what happens if I type in Palouse silt loam. It says the series name Palouse silt loam does not exist. And obviously we know that it does. So the trick is just type in Palouse, all right? Forget about the silt loam part of it. Or if you've got another series, the Alpha Sandy loam, just type in Alpha, okay? And it should be okay. It should work. Did anybody else run into difficulties using this? The other issue too is Web Soil Survey. And sometimes it's, for all the good features that it has, and there are a lot of them, it's a little bit clunky to use. And one alternative, if you are interested, is if you're using, some of you use Google Earth, and there's a really nice add-on for Google Earth that you can get from the University of California, Davis. All you have to type in is UC Davis Soil Web. Something like that, and it's one of these KMZ file extensions that you can download and you put it into Google Earth, and then what will happen, you can use Google Earth and you click on this KMZ file, and what it will do is overlay the polygons of the soils that are mapped there, and then in the center there'll be a number and a little dot, and if you get your cursor over and click on the dot in the center, it'll tell you what the series or the map unit name is, and it'll even give you a little profile of this component series in that map unit. So it's kind of neat, and it's a lot easier to use than Web Soil Survey if you're just interested in learning learning what soils are in a given area. And I'd be glad to show you how it works if you're interested. Okay, so that's due on Thursday, and what we're going to do Thursday in lab is, actually this Thursday and next Thursday as well, is do soil profile descriptions. And we're really going to focus on horizonation, since that's what we've been talking about for the last couple of class periods. And what we'll do is have a number of the monoliths that are in the teaching lab and out in the hallway, the selected ones, and have you go around and try your hand at coming up with some sort of a reasonable description of the horizons that are there and the relative depths and things like that. And I'll give you more instruction on Thursday. But once again, it's an exercise that I would recommend you do with somebody else, maybe a small group if you want. And it's one of these things that you can do it at your own pace, because I'll leave the information on the monoliths out, so you can kind of do it as time permits. Okay, so this morning I want to finish up what we were doing with the horizon designations. If you remember back on Thursday, we were talking about subordinate distinctions, and I don't know if we had completely gotten through all of those. I think the last three that were on the list are the, if you look on your sheet, it's the ones that I have, do you have your sheet with you?
Limnic materials?
Yeah, the one on the very back that says limnic materials. And I think just to take a moment and go through those, these are ones I said are only used with that L master horizon symbol, which we don't use that often, and that's the one that stands for the lacustrine type materials or lake freshwater type sediments. I can't remember where we left off, but what does CO stand for? All right, you spoke up, Taylor. What?
Coprogenous.
Coprogenous earth, yeah, CO. And what is that?
Copros is an animal.
Yeah, remember we talked about drit, the Old Norse word? Same thing. And it can come from a variety of aquatic organisms, and it will accumulate at the bottom of a lake setting, for example. And that's one of the possibilities for these limnic materials. How about MA? What's that stand for? Marl. And marl is? Yeah, it tends to be a calcareous clay material. Sometimes it has little shell fragments in it, depending on the environment. But often fairly light colored because it does have the calcium carbonate in it. And then the last one is DI. And what does that stand for?
Diatomaceous earth.
Yeah, diatomaceous earth, which is?
A limnic layer of diatomaceous earth used with all.
Yeah, it's something from diatoms. And these are these little organisms that accumulate silicon. And when they die, you've got this little skeleton of their bodies, and then those things kind of pile up. They're real interesting looking, very cool to look at with magnification because of the different sorts of morphologies and shapes that you see. But again, these are not that common. So let me, I think we started running through some of these examples here, is that right? I'm having a difficult time. We didn't. Okay, well, does anybody remember? Okay. Well, let me just, I can run it up to the, start at the beginning here. If I get confused, you've got to give me a little bit of slack because I'm doing the intro soils course right now and we're covering kind of the same material. And I get a little, working back and forth, I get a little bit confused about what I've said or what I haven't. So
we did like the volcanic ash glacial outwash.
Okay. But this is the first one on that handout that we've got. And what I'm going to do is show you some examples of the horizon sequences and primarily focusing on examples of these different subordinate distinctions and how they're used. So typical grassland soil profile. You've got A horizon up at the top, very well expressed. Here's one of these transition horizons, BA, kind of in between. BT, T stands for clay. And then down here where you start seeing the white material at the bottom, a BK, and the K is calcium carbonate. Very common horizon sequence in grassland soils from arid or semi-arid regions. More of a forest profile, an O horizon up on top that's a little difficult to see, and the I used with the O means what?
Intermediate.
In this case, slight decomposition. In other words, you would have a very high fiber content, and you probably could identify what the source of that O horizon material was, pine needles or broadleaf leaves, something like that. The A horizon, not very well expressed, E horizon, another BT, and then transition down below. And one of the keys of these T horizons, you saw this in lab last week, are the clay coatings, or the argillands, and it maybe wasn't quite that dramatic, but I think most of you were able to see the the waxy brownish coating on there. And if you read the fine print about BT horizons, that's one of the ideas, is that there is evidence, as in the form of clay films, where you've had clay that has been moving from up above and accumulating in there.
How long does it take for that wax to form?
Well, some of the research that has been done suggests that you can start to get clays moving in a very relatively short period of time, maybe, you know, on the order of a few decades, to where it would be noticeable. But to get something like that, probably you're looking at a soil that's considerably older. Normally we think about the really well-developed BT horizons as representing a certain amount of landscape stability. So you're getting into the thousands of years, or maybe tens of thousands of years.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And this kind of feature is not so easy to do weathering or to wash out?
It can, but normally what happens is, given a certain climatic regime, you're going to have a wetting front that goes down to more or less the same depth, you know, year after year. So you'll tend to find most of these clay films within a certain range from the soil surface. And if you get more precipitation, they're going to be further down. Less precipitation, not so much. Okay, the O stands for, remember this? Yeah, residual sesquioxides. And I don't know if we talked about this, but notice what's been done here, BO1, BO2, BO3. These are simply vertical subdivisions of what, in this case, is a very thick residual accumulation of iron and aluminum oxides. And there are no hard and fast rules on how to do this. Sometimes people just break these horizons out arbitrarily. Other times you might see a distinct difference somewhere and you think, well, that looks different than this, so that's fair game for putting a horizon break in there. Yeah?
So if you're doing it arbitrarily, what's the purpose?
Well, okay, in a case like this, this is almost 5.5 feet of soil profile. Let's say you wanted to sample it and for fertility testing, whatever the case may be. Chances are that this BO1 horizon is going to be very different than the BO3 horizon down at the bottom. And my recommendation is, all you generally don't want to have horizons that are more than about 30 centimeters or 12 inches thick. That's kind of my guideline, but because generally there's enough variation that if you just sample this whole thing as one horizon, well, you might be missing some of the variability that's in there. Okay, remember the H and the S? The H stands for?
Organic matter.
Yeah, and what? Illuvial organic matter, right? In other words, it's some sort of solubilized organic matter that's moved down. And in this profile, you've got a pretty well expressed E horizon. And the materials that move out of that E horizon are going to accumulate below. So this darker horizon right in here, this is designated as a BHS. So it's got this illuvial humus that's complexed with iron and aluminum. And then a little bit further down, you don't see the dark color so much. That's just being designated as BS, with the S standing for illuvial iron and aluminum. So kind of a very common horizon sequence where you have an E, and if you got an E horizon, that means you've lost material, so probably below it you're going to have a B horizon, and you identify the materials that have accumulated there. Another example of a very similar one, E horizon, and then that dark layer in there would probably best be designated as just a BH horizon for the illuvial humus. And then the C horizon below it. You don't see much evidence of these sesquioxides because typically those are reddish, brownish, yellowish colors, and not much of that in there. Remember, N stands for sodium. And this is the best example I could find of a soil profile with a BN horizon, high exchangeable sodium. And somebody mentioned this in class the other day, the lower right-hand corner. This is, you're looking down at the top of columnar structure. And this is something in a BN horizon that that's probably where you're going to see columnar structure most of the time. And it tends to be characteristic of these sodium-affected soils. And a very interesting look. And these are only about just a few inches below the soil surface. It's from what, this comes from an area what the range people call slick spots that you find out in the sagebrush areas. And if you dig in a slick spot, you're probably going to find this BN horizon fairly close to the surface. The G, glade colors, low chroma colors. You can see the subsoil in this picture right here. It's just gray. You don't really see much evidence of reds and yellows and browns. So good indicator of a wet or waterlogged soil, one we call poorly drained. The water is also a giveaway there. You see it in the bottom of the pit. Not a good soil for most of the typical land uses. Okay, this is another one of our volcanic ash soils from around here. The top horizon, this is in forest environment, so OA, OI horizon, something up there at the top. It's kind of difficult to separate those out. Very weakly expressed A horizon, BW1, and this is a volcanic ash up here, the reddish-brown material. What's the W stand for? Yeah, kind of a weak B horizon. In this case, the evidence of a B horizon or the significant alteration of parent material is going to be the color, got high chroma, and maybe a little bit of structure, but you have not accumulated anything to the point of being able to use a T or an S or anything like that. So almost by default, we put a W on it, meaning weak development. Now, this is kind of interesting. We get down below this depth. The next horizon is a 2, meaning it's a second parent material, right? And the fancy term for that is lithologic discontinuity. You might run across that. You impress your friends with that. But notice how the numbering goes. So you got BW1 and then a 2, BW2. So this is all considered a BW horizon, and that's why you've got the vertical subdivisions, the 1 and the 2. But in this case, you end up sticking the indicator of this lithologic discontinuity or the second parent material in front of it. So there are a few conventions for how these things get used, and I don't want to worry too much about them right now, but as we use these things, I think you'll start to see some of the patterns. Okay, another example of a BW horizon right in this zone right in here from about maybe 20 centimeters down to half a meter, somewhere right in there. And again, probably the only evidence that you see of significant alteration of the parent material is that, well, two things. You've probably lost a little bit of carbonate out of there, but the development of some soil structure. And that may be about it. And so that's why we're using the weak B horizon designation there. BK horizon, carbonates below, and eventually a C horizon down. And the next one is one of these durapans that I showed you in lab on Thursday, the BKQM horizon. This was the one that you guys saw on the lab bench, and it was sitting in water, and it was still a very coherent cemented mass. You can see there's actually two cementing agents in this horizon. The K is calcium carbonate and the Q is silica. And I think you might even consider writing this as a BKKQM because it's got enough carbonate in there to plug it. But either way, it's fine. So we've got two cementing agents, and the M, of course, being the subordinate distinction for cementation. So you can actually string together quite a few of these subordinate distinctions in some cases. Yeah?
I was thinking about the sample that we saw in the lab. Uh-huh. This is really strong. To break it, you can break it with a shovel.
You might be able to break it with a shovel, but It kind of depends on the thickness of them. And one like this, where it starts to be a couple feet thick, you could conceivably pick through it with a shovel, but that'd be a lot of work. You'd be better off with some dynamite or get a big cat and rip through it, which is what they typically do. They are fairly strong. And a lot of, I think I mentioned this, a lot of the folks refer to this stuff as lime rock, and because it really is like rock, but more precisely, a soil horizon, or a BKQM horizon. The Z's stand for
salts,
and these are more soluble than gypsum by definition. You can see the salt crust up top, and then a BZ horizon right below it. So a good indicator of a saline soil, saline environment, and I suspect in most cases where you've got where you're using a Z as a subordinate distinction, you've probably got a very unusual plant community. The folks at Map Soils have always said that these saline soils are very easy to map because you just look for where the plant community changes, and that's where the salty soils are. Remember the F for permafrost, and this is a soil from Alaska. This layer from right here, the white material from here on down, we're designating as a CF, and this is permafrost, or the zone in the soil that this does not thaw out. Above it, this would thaw out on an annual basis, and it's what we often call the active layer, but this stays frozen, permanently frozen, and so we would use the permafrost designation. Now this next one is closely related, but this is from Antarctica. Remember the double F. Yeah, this is dry permafrost. The difference here is this soil comes from an area that probably gets about, 50 millimeters of annual precips, just a tiny amount. So there's not enough water in the soil to form ice to cement the whole thing together. So even though this is permanently frozen with just a couple percent water in there, it's pretty loose material. And it does not stay cemented together by the ice or held together by the ice. So a very different type of permafrost. Yeah?
So in terms of soil formation, like, is it slowly aging, or did the climate change and this is an old soil?
Well, it's probably very old, and because of that has undergone several variations in climate. But you notice on this one, there's not even an A horizon up there, nothing that looks like it. And probably there is a little bit of an enrichment of organic matter up there, but the research that they've done on this, it's probably microbial biomass. And they don't know if it's windblown or what, but most of these areas, they are so dry and cold, they don't support vascular plants.
How come there's no B horizon?
I think there might be in this. We'll revisit this when we get into the gelisols, but I think there is a, starting at the top, they call it a BW horizon. But yeah, some of these gelisols are very old, but they don't show much evidence of soil development. Okay, how would you like to do a description of this soil? This is from a colleague up in Alaska who's worked quite a bit with these frozen soils. And I just put this in here to show, well, a couple things. Remember we talked about the W horizon, and I talked about the floating bogs where you might find it. Here's another example. This is just a big ice wedge that's found in the soil profile. And you notice the designation there, W, water, but it's frozen in this case, or simply ice. So that's a good way to designate ice. And then you can see the F subordinate distinction being used here for the permafrost. And then a couple other things. Here's an OEJJ. What is that? Anybody want to take a stab at it?
Now we're going to have jarosite in it.
That's the single J. Yeah, you'd think the double J would be lots of jarosite, but that's not the way it works.
Double J is the freezing and thawing in terms of it.
Right. The double J is showing effects of cryoturbation or freeze-thaw. And you notice how these horizon, you've got this big ice wedge, and all these horizon boundaries have been disrupted. So if you look at this soil fabric, it's can't really see it in here, but it really is kind of all mixed up, and you kind of the structure development is in different at different angles, so it's very unusual. And of course, the OE means it's organic material, and the E would be moderate decomposition. Now you also see the G in here for some glade materials. A lot going on in these things. And it's really, in the, more than anything else in this case, it's because of the cryoturbation and the associated processes with that. Okay, remember, you saw this in lab last week. The BTX, that's what we call a fragipan. And that was the material I put in water. And what happened to it? It what? Yeah, it slaked in water, and it was just, it all came apart. And if you picked up the chunks of that fragipan that were on the lab bench, you know it's very dense material and very hard, but when you put it in water, it just falls apart. So it's not cemented, and that's kind of typical where we use this X, where it's the hard and brittle type material, but it's not cemented. It just lacks much, it doesn't have much porosity, and that's why it has those physical characteristics. And hopefully we'll be looking at a couple of these later in the semester when we get outside.
Is there a, I don't know if y'all want to say a hard test rule or anything, but something that says usual depth to either one or the other?
To where you would find this?
To actually how deep it would be.
I don't know if there's a rule. I think around here, and that this is a profile from a local soil, that, well, this one is just under a meter in depth, and that'd be pretty common. And it probably has to do with several factors, climatic and related to parent material and so on. But in general, I'd say no, there's probably not a general rule. Yeah?
Because I see like a, it's not like an O or an A horizon at the top. Are these just to drive home the main points, or is that just the complete soil profile?
Well, in this case, that would not be the complete soil profile. Yeah, this would be an A horizon. This is typically a BW. You might even have an E in some of these right above that pan.
This is when going back to look at it later.
Yeah. All right, another subordinate distinction. Remember the V. Stood for, it's only been 5 days.
Plinthite.
You guys knew all of these.
Plinthite.
And we said that was a sesquioxide rich, humus poor soil material that was firm, and upon exposure to wetting and drying cycles, it hardens irreversibly into laterite or ironstone or one of those types of names. And this is the plinthite down at the very bottom. It's kind of a reddish, yellow, gray, mottled appearance. And above it, the BT horizon, an AP, the P stands for plowing, and then a little bit of an E horizon there as well. Oh, and this note, so a lot of these plinthite layers are typically found in moister climates, and a lot of them are in the tropical, subtropical regions. And when you have plinthite in soils, there are areas where they don't really have rock resources. So what they do is they dig this plinthite out in blocks like this, put it out in the sun, let it dry, and it might take a few wetting and drying cycles, but eventually it achieves this hardness, and that's used as construction material. Make buildings out of it, and pretty much anything that you would perhaps be using rock for. So a very, very important construction material in certain parts of the world. Okay, the profile here, the C with the lowercase r, what does that mean? How do we define that?
Soil
weathered or soft bedrock?
Yeah, this would be weathered or soft bedrock. And I think from the practical standpoint, it's something that could be dug with a shovel. And that was the case here. And I think if you look at this, you can kind of see, this is some weathered granite, but you kind of see that appearance of granite rock. But it's weathered to the point where you can break it apart in your hands, you can dig through it without too much trouble. And this would be the situation where you wouldn't want to designate it with the capital R, which is the hard bedrock, but this would be the soft weathered bedrock. The SS?
Slick and size.
Yeah, slick and size. We said that's the feature that you can see here, these clay films. Are the PED faces that are shiny, striated, like that. And interestingly enough, I think the SS is only used with B horizons. NRCS has decreed that there's no such thing as an ASS horizon, I guess for obvious reasons. But so whenever you see these things, BSS horizon. Okay, here's an interesting one for you. What would an APD represent? What's P? Okay, and what's D?
Dense.
A lot of you have heard of the term plow pan. It's something that you find in a lot of ag fields as a result of repeated cultivation. And what you're looking at here is a dense layer that has essentially been compacted by cultivation practices. So not only is it plowed, but it's also quite dense. And in this case, they come in with something known as a subsoiler, and they rip a shank kind of rips this apart, and this allows the roots to get down into the subsoil. Otherwise, this is dense enough that the plant roots aren't able to penetrate through. The other thing about this, you notice this real distinct boundary here? Okay, that's always good evidence of a plow layer, because normally the cultivation goes down to a specific depth, and you might see that plow layer as forms a very abrupt boundary with the underlying material.
So to get rid of that?
You can come in and you can churn it up and probably take care of the problem for the short term, but long term, there's really not too much you can do about it.
Is there a certain type of like soil texture that this happens to?
This particular example comes from the southeast, and they tend to be fairly sandy soils. So I'd say the loamier to sandier soils are the ones where this is probably more of a problem.
What are they growing? Just curious.
This is soybeans.
Soybean.
Yeah. Another example of an AP horizon, and I just want to point out the very, once again, very abrupt boundary. And that's always good evidence of some kind of disturbance. And in this case, it's an ag field, so that disturbance would be the plowing. Small B stands for
buried.
And I think I mentioned the other day, it's most typically a buried A horizon. And this is a setting along a stream. And you notice the different layers of material that have been deposited by the stream. Well, some of these darker areas in here, like there's a good example, that at one time was the soil surface. So you had a well-expressed A horizon there. It subsequently got buried by newer material deposited there. So it's no longer the active A horizon. So we would put that B on there to indicate that it's buried. And I guess this would be, this upper part here would be the active B horizon or A horizon now. So it simply means a situation where horizon has been buried by some sort of overburden. It could be natural like this, or you even see it used in urban settings where you've got materials that get fill gets dumped on top of them and so on. It might be another place you'd use the buried horizon. Okay, and yeah, Kendall.
So how would you distinguish between a buried A horizon and something like age horizon or something, or just had some of those, would it just be more situational with knowing the history of that land?
Okay, how would you distinguish between this AB horizon and a BH? They're probably going to look very similar, but you're right. It may be situational. If you're in a alluvial setting like that, where you know you're getting floods from time to time and new material deposit, that'd be one clue. The other thing is, because the H stands for alluvial humus, you're probably going to see an E horizon above it. Because normally if you want to say something is alluvial or it's moved, then you want to have some pretty good evidence of a horizon above it that it's come from. All right, well, you'll get to practice with some of these on Thursday and even next week when you start trying to do some of these, looking at some of our monoliths and do the descriptions on those. Yeah?
Since you said at the bottom of the monolith, when the horizons that they're mapped out, they're not always accurate.
I don't think I said they weren't accurate. I think I said I wouldn't do it the same way.
You wouldn't do it the same way.
Yeah.
Would that be a reference to check our work would be?
No, and in fact, I'm going to cover those up and advise you to not even look at them. All right? Because I think what it does is it biases you, and you think, I'll look, check and see what the right answer is. And in many cases, I'm not sure that represents the right answer. Keep in mind with these horizon designations that they are, to a large extent, subjective. In other words, it's an interpretation of what you see and how you interpret what's going on there. And I mentioned this to several of you, that you could get a couple of very well-qualified soil scientists to do horizon descriptions of soil profiles, and they're not going to be the same. There are going to be some differences. In some cases, they might be quite different, but hopefully, in their own way, they're both conveying the same general information. So as you do these, don't think of it as a right answer and a wrong answer. There are just some that are better than others, perhaps. Okay, well, that pretty much wraps up the section on soil morphology. So we've got all those features we talked about, the horizon designations, and these are things that are just going to be a recurring theme from here on out for the rest of the semester. So some of the horizon designations you're not going to think too much about again, but some of them you'll see again and again and again. So what I want to do is move on to the second unit in this class, and this is the one on soil formation and weathering. And I think to start off, the way I'd like to approach it is to talk a little bit about soil formation and the models or concepts that we have to describe it. And believe it or not, I think you guys have probably been exposed to at least one or maybe both of these models of soil formation. Does this ring a bell with anybody? Yeah, okay, so how about this? We have capital S is equal to F, and then in parentheses you put CL, O, R, P, and T. And what do we call that thing, that formula or that equation?
It's
just
what creates soil.
Yeah, it's kind of what creates soil, or the five factors of soil formation. And this is something that was proposed back in 1941 by a soil scientist named Hans Jenny, who was at University of California at Berkeley. And he's not the first person that ever realized that these are soil forming factors, but he's probably the first person that really put it in a form like this, at least in the United States, that people could kind of grasp this way. And I think some of you already were talking about what these variables stand for. CL is climate, and O is organisms, R is Yeah, and what's a better word? I don't like relief, but...
Topography.
Hmm?
Topography?
Topography, landscape position. It's really nothing more than where that soil sits out on a landscape. You know, steep slope versus a gentle slope, by a stream versus on a mountainside. Relief really doesn't capture that. The P stands for? Yeah, parent material. And the T is for time. So those are the five factors of soil formation. And I guess here's a way that you might separate them a little bit. These first two, climate and organisms, are what we call, or some people have referred to as flux factors, because they actually represent the factors that result in additions of matter and energy to the soil. Because climate, you think about the soil temperature, the solar energy that is reaching a soil profile, precipitation, the actual addition of water to a soil. Organisms produce organic material that ends up getting added to the soil. So these represent flux factors, whereas these guys, the relief and parent material, are what some refer to as state factors. In other words, they don't really change, but they just describe the nature of the system there. And time is sort of an oddball. We treat it a little bit separately. But I like to say that soils and soil profiles are like snowflakes, that no two of them are exactly the same. And the reason they're not is because there is always going to be variability in one or more of these soil forming factors as you go compare one soil to another. And they could even be close by, but maybe the difference in relief is just enough that it causes some slight differences in the way that soil looks. Well, as I mentioned, this came out in about 1941, and to be honest, we really haven't improved on it a whole lot. And a lot of people have criticized this from the standpoint of a mathematical expression. And the reason being that is, do you think that's a very solvable type of equation? Probably not, unless you could come up with one variable that would represent organisms. Pretty difficult to do when you think that organisms include vegetation, it includes microbes, a lot of things go into it. And I think that's the case with all of them. It would be difficult to solve this thing mathematically. But nevertheless, it does serve as a very useful conceptual model. And probably most of what we know about how soils form, the manner in which they form, has been derived from applying these five soil forming factors and this equation to soils on a landscape. And I'll give you an example of how this might work. One of the things that the research in soil formation has relied upon is finding situations where, let's say, one of these soil forming factors, draw a landscape out here. You've got soil A over here and soil B over here. So they're separated by some distance. But the idea would be if we could find a situation where we get different soils, and in terms of the soil forming factors, we might be able to say that for soil A and soil B there, climate's exactly the same, organisms are exactly the same, so same vegetation, the relief, they're both on a flat, nearly level landscape, they're the same. They're the same age, time's no different. Maybe the only difference here is parent material. So we've got some sort of geological situation where this is granite and this is basalt. So soil A is formed in granite, soil B in basalt. All other soil forming factors are let's say for intents and purposes they're the same, this allows us to actually look at the direct effect of parent material on soil formation. So it is kind of used conceptually that way. And we might call this, where we've got two different parent materials, everything else is the same, the fancy word, I think this is in your book, lithosequence. And all that means is it's a sequence of soils, I only drew two, but it could be, you know, as many as you want, that are similar in all respects except for the lithology, or in this case, parent material. Another really common example of how we have been able to apply this, the five factors of soil formation, to actually doing some quantitative work on soil formation, is to utilize what is referred to as a chronosequence. Anybody want to offer a guess at what a chronosequence is? Yeah, it's a time sequence of soils where you've essentially got the climate, the organisms, the relief, and the parent material similar, or for all intents and purposes the same, but the soils differ in their age. And I'll show you an example of that here. And this is on the handout. I don't know if you guys have printed this off yet, but this is the next, I think it's... It's on the website there, but I think it's called the handout for models of soil formation would be the name of it. So this first slide is just a nice postcard type picture of what Boise looks like. And the thing that I'm trying to point out here is that, you know, if you've been to Boise, the Boise River runs right through it. And associated with the Boise River are these various terraces that are different levels. And if you know anything about geology, they are different ages. So right next to the Boise River, you've got what's known as the Boise Terrace, which is the lowest one. And then there's one called the Sunrise. You go up higher, the Gowan Terrace, this is where the airport is. You go up one more in the 5 Mile Terrace. And finally, the one that is the highest elevation is referred to as the 10 Mile Terrace. So which of those would be oldest? Yeah, the higher they are, the older they are. And in the case of these terraces in the Boise area, this is a cross section, this next image. The 10 Mile Terrace, you can see right here, that's the highest terrace level, is estimated based on the dating of rocks and so on and some of the basalt flows there, about 1.7 million years old. This is what the geologists say. The Sunrise Terrace in here, based on various dating techniques, about 300,000 years old. The Whitney Terrace here, 130,000 year old. And then the Boise Terrace right adjacent to the river, the lowest one, is only about 14,000 years old. So here's the idea of a chronosequence. You've got these terraces. This is all alluvial material, right? It's been laid down by the Boise River various times. Let's assume it's similar parent material. The vegetation has probably been the same. Not too much difference in climate here because there's not that much difference in elevation. So you end up with a good example of a chronosequence. And there's an example of 14,000-year-old soil. There's the 130,000-year-old soil, and you're starting to form one of these carbonate and silica cemented subsoils in it. You get up to the 300,000-year-old terrace, and you've got a pretty well-developed Durapan, or one of these BKQM horizons. And finally, on the oldest, the 10-mile terrace, you get this really thick, very, very strongly cemented BKQM horizon. So what we're doing here is taking it one step further. We can actually look at how much calcium carbonate has accumulated in these things. And since we know the ages, we can plot this out over time. And you can see these red curves here you can develop a mathematical expression that describes the accumulation of silica or the accumulation of calcium carbonate as a function of time. And this has been done in a lot of different places besides Boise, but it's probably the way that we have learned the most about how long it takes various soil horizons to form or various soil constituents to accumulate. Okay, I'm going to stop there and we will pick this up on Thursday.